Welcome back to the third day of our Tensor Network workshop. Today we will have three speakers and afterwards a discussion session later in the afternoon. And we're very happy to have Janet Hung here from Fudan University, and she will give the first talk about realistic holographic tensor networks from p-adic CFT to minimal CFT2.
First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to speak here. What I'm going to talk about is some work in progress done with some of our students and postdocs and also a collaborator, Roshri. I'll introduce them later. So this is some work that has been ongoing for quite a while, probably since 2018, and it is part of our effort trying to make a very concrete realization of some of the ideas of understanding holography in terms of tensor networks. Some of these things we have heard about in the talks in the previous 2 days, and I hope that I might be able to provide a slightly different perspective or a complementary perspective along these lines. The outline of my talk is as follows. My talk would be divided into two parts. The first part is going to be about these p-adic tensor networks. So one reason for working with p-adic tensor network, as we're going to see, is that it is extremely simple. The CFT realized by these tensor network is extremely simple. And so it allows us to make very concrete and quantitative computations recreate many of the properties of the ADS CFT. And in the second part of the talk, which would be slightly shorter, and it's as you can see, there are many question marks, so it is still at a very fairly early stage of the project. But I hope that I will be able to show you that the p-adic tensor network actually give us quite a few inspirations that allows us to combine recent discoveries in various different areas that allows us to make hopefully some progress in constructing holographic tensor networks for more realistic CFTs, particularly all those minimal models that are connected to these topological orders, as we're going to see. Okay, so let us start with tensor network, ADS-CFT, and what exactly did we do with this p-adic tensor network. So as we heard already in yesterday's in the talks in yesterday and on Monday, holography get connected to tensor. The idea of ADS-CFT got connected to tensor networks because of the Ryu Takinagi formula, really, that started all these things. It was first pointed out by Swingle, there's a profound similarity between how entanglement entropy is being computed in the ADS-CFT and how one could estimate the amount of entanglement in a mirror tensor network. Basically, in the case of ADS-CFT, we compute the area of a minimal surface that connects to the boundary CFT and the region A. It connects to the boundary of at the boundary CFT surrounding the region A where we want to compute the entanglement. And in the case of the mirror tensor network, it is a cut through the tensor network, a minimal cut through the tensor network that give us an estimate of the entanglement entropy. And so in both cases, we can see that the entanglement is geometrized. It becomes a geometric data. And that suggests that ADS-CFT is profoundly connected to tensor networks, and tensor network provide a geometrization of the entanglement information of the CFT. But for people who has been working on these problems, it is very, very difficult to make a very to make a tensor network that describes a very specific CFT. So when the bulk, when we have a very good control of a bulk tensor network, then it becomes extremely hard to control the properties of the CFT. And when we know the CFT very well, then oftentimes it is very difficult to control a network that faithfully describes the CFT. And so so that was one of the motivation why in the past couple of years we started working on a p-adic CFT. And so in the first part of my talk, I'll talk about very recent progress in constructing these tensor networks that describes p-adic CFT, and also in deriving various parts of the ADS-CFT dictionary emerges very naturally in these holographic tensor networks. But in order to talk about a p-adic ADS-CFT and the tensor network description, I have to say a few words about what a p-adic CFT for people who are not already familiar with this problem. So usually when we talk about CFT, we have space-time coordinates, and these space-time coordinates are real numbers. In the case of a p-adic CFT, what happens is that we put the CFT, these space-time coordinates are no longer real numbers. Instead, they are p-adic numbers. So p-adic numbers is a slightly different number field that are also field extensions of rational numbers. So real numbers are extension of rational numbers, and so are these p-adic numbers. So all rational numbers are also p-adic numbers. And our CFT, so for simplicity, we can consider a one-dimensional p-adic CFT. So it only has one coordinate, x, and this x belongs to QP. So this p here is a prime number. So every prime number P defines a p-adic number field. Each of these p-adic number can be expressed in terms of an infinite series. And you can think of this infinite series really as expressing X with base P. And so these AMs runs from 0 to P minus 1. There would be an overall factor p to the v. V is also an integer. So if I require that v is some integer and also that am, where m equals zero, the leading term, has it cannot be zero, then this expression is unique also, and every p-adic number get expressed in this particular way. And one could define the notion of norms for these p-adic numbers, and that is basically extracting the leading power and taking the inverse. So these norms defines the size of these p-adic numbers, the magnitude of these p-adic numbers, and they have a very different notion of big and small compared to the real numbers. And when we talk about the distance between two points, we can just take the difference between two p-adic numbers and take the p-adic norm. So let me stress that the p-adic norm satisfies all the usual axioms of distances, and so basically it is a measure of so this gives a measure of the size of these p-adic numbers. Now how do we do conformal transformation in this p-adic CFT? So in a one-dimensional CFT, we can do Mobius transformations. So in a real CFT, what we would do is that we would take the coordinate x and we transform it to the point ax plus b cx plus d. In the case of p-adic numbers, all the difference there is that we take a, b, c, d to be p-adic numbers. And so this ABCD forms a matrix group belonging to this projective general linear group PGL to QP. So this is completely analogous to what happens in CFT, except we replace ABCD by p-adic numbers. So to cut a long story short, so what are the things that we know about Piatic CFT? You can really view it as more or less like real CFT, except you replace all the rules that you already know about real CFT by Piatic numbers and Piatic norms. So to specify a CFT, we need to list the spectrum. We need to know all the primaries, and the primaries transform in exactly the way it does in a real CFT, except the transformation is now replaced by these Piatic norms, and you also have to specify the conformal dimension of these operators. Then you have to specify, once you know what the operators are, you have to specify the OPE of these operators, and so you have to specify the structure constants of the fusion between these operators. So, with the OPEs, then you can now start to compute correlation functions, and so using symmetries, you can immediately tell that two-point functions take the following form, which is exactly like a real CFT, except you have to replace the distance by this Piatic norm, and three-point functions would depend on the structure constants, and you can see that it has exactly the same form as a usual real CFT, again replacing everything by Piatic norms. So And moreover, you can start computing four-point function. And one interesting thing about these Piatic CFT is that roughly speaking, they don't have any descendants. And the conformal blocks look fairly trivial. The four-point functions are not trivial. So as you change the distances, that would be so the conformal blocks look trivial when you evaluate it on any specific separation of these operators. But when you move these operators, they might jump suddenly. But at every point, it would appear that it doesn't have any descendants. And so when you want to look into the constraints of crossing symmetry, you're going to find that it doesn't give you much constraints. So it doesn't tell you constraints on the structure constants or the spectrum, except that the fusion coefficients, the structure coefficients, should be the fusion rules should be associative. So in this sense, it is very simple, because you don't have to worry about descendants, and so the theory looks very simple. But the downside is, of course, there's too much room for doing almost anything you wish. So what exactly is Piatic ADS-CFT? Piatic ADS-CFT was, I think, proposed in 2017-18 by Gubser and company, and also Hedeman and collaborators. What they hope is to find a geometric dual to that could potentially be dual to these Piatic CFT, and now in an analogous way to ADS being dual to CFT. So the way it worked out is that let's say for simplicity in one dimensions, the upper half plane, which is ADS2, is the supposed dual of CFT1. So the upper half plane is has an isometry group, which is the conformal symmetry SL2R, but it really is the quotient of SL2R by its maximal compact subgroup, SO2R. So the upper half plane can be thought of as this quotient. And so the idea was, if there is a dual to the Piatic CFT, the conformal group is now PGL to QP. And let's look for the corresponding maximal subgroup, compact subgroup, and really the isotopy group, and let's take the quotient, and that would be the appropriate object, that a geometric object that is dual to the Piatic CFT. And so the result of this quotient is very interesting. It turns out that this bulk is discrete, and the conformal group PGL2QP acts transitively on this geometry. And so that was the proposed dual of the Piatic CFT. So what does this bulk look like? This bulk looks like a tree, and it is called the Brudhartitz tree. These people, they looked into, they assumed the same ADS-CFT dictionary, basically defining a Bok theory on this tree, and tried to compute Witten diagrams, very much like the usual ADS-CFT dictionary, and they find that they can reproduce correlation functions of the dual CFT and so on. So what we did was the following. So that was some work done with Wei and Charles back in 2018 and 19. And so what we thought was that if the bulk is discrete, it is very, very tempting to put a tensor network that covers this BT tree. So we proposed a very specific tensor network that covers this BT tree. And we want to recover not the wave function of the p-adic CFT. We don't really know what is the wave function of the p-adic CFT, but rather we want to reproduce the partition function of this p-adic CFT. So in this tensor network that covers the BT tree, what we did is that we first determine what are the labels that goes into these tensors. And the most natural thing is to put in the primaries, onto labels. So these labels, so each leg now takes values in this that enumerates all the primary operators of the dual CFT, of the CFT. And so at each vertex, it turns out that the most natural thing to do is to put in the fusion, the structure constants that specify the CFT. Moreover, over each leg, it has to be weighted by some factor that is dependent on the dimension, on the conformal dimension of these primary operators. So to summarize, the specific tensor network that we propose is such that every vertex is a structure constant and every leg is weighted by p to the minus delta, where delta is the conformal dimension of this particular leg. And when you want to compute the partition function with no operator insertion, then what you do is that this tensor network, it has a asymptotic boundary, so very much like the upper half plane, and there we have to do a cutoff, and if we don't have any operator insertion, then we will project these dangling legs at the boundary of this ADS space to the identity operator, or the identity label. And if the operator is if we have an operator insertion, then instead at that particular point we project it to the specific label corresponding to the operator. So what happens is that if now I want to compute two-point functions, so at these two particular points I project the operator to this interesting label, then because this is a fusion tree down, you will see that if the neighboring labels are trivial, then this operator would just propagate down this tree until it meets the other operator. And every time it goes down a particular leg, it would get a weight of p to the minus delta. And it just happens that, first of all, if you collect, the result of the two-point function is proportional to p to the minus delta d, where d is the length of the geodesic that goes through this tree. Not surprisingly, when this shows up, the geodesic length basically reproduces the p-adic norm of the separation of these two points. Moreover, this p to the minus delta d, where d is the geodesic length, is precisely, this object here is precisely the solution of the Laplace, the Klein-Gordon equation on this discrete graph. And so in this sense, we sort of reproduce the dictionary of ADS CFT, which emerges naturally in this tensor network. The notion of Witten diagrams and bulk boundary propagators just emerges in this tensor network. And we're guaranteed to recover the CFT because it is designed to do so. That was some old work that unfortunately I spent quite a bit of time to review. So what exactly is what is the interesting thing that we did afterwards? So we have been looking at the case where there is no we have a CFT. What if there is renormalization group flow? How to do renormalization group flow? That was also explored back in 2019. So we realized that to mimic a renormalization group flow, what you want to do is that instead of projecting all the boundary legs to the identity operator, you want to introduce at every single leg some other operators, turn on some other operators at every single boundary legs. That is the analogy of turning on a relevant operator in a CFT. And once you do that, you can immediately see that if I have everything zero at the boundary, this network would just give you 0, 0 fuse to 0, 0, 0 fuse to 0. And so the contribution of the vertices at every layer are the same. But once I introduce J, then the contribution at every layer would just start to shift. In fact, you can if I feed in this, I call a coupling state J, at the boundary, then the resultant, I would get a new state here after fusing these two J's, and I could call that J n plus one. Or if I start with J lambda plus one, and then I would get a new state J lambda. And when I have J lambda fused with J lambda, I get yet another J lambda minus one. And so you can see some kind of RG flow and the contribution of the tensor network visibly changes as you move down the tensor network. And so one question is, can we read off some kind of Einstein equation out of this network? To what extent we could do that? And so our student and our postdoc, Lin and Xirong, they did some very interesting analysis. So what happens is that, so we're studying these boundary legs with 0 plus J, turning on some coupling J. So in order to have Einstein equation, what you want to do is that you have to have, so first of all, you have to have matter, and that matter, you want to compute stress tensor for this matter. So first thing you have to have, so by turning on these boundary J's, then certainly you would have some expectation value of some bulk operator. So how do we compute expectation value of bulk operators? What we do is that inserting a bulk operator really correspond to inserting an extra leg to a vertex in the bulk. And so if I insert an extra leg in the bulk, then you will see that, let's say if I do consider things perturbatively, J is equals to mostly zero with a small addition of a new operator, then you can see that to linear order in the perturbation, then you would find let's say this leg J from this leg, it will propagate down until it hits this bulk insertion, and as this leg propagates down the fusion tree, I would pick up basically P to the minus delta D, where D is now the separation between the boundary and this bulk point. And so I would basically pick up a Green's function, a bulk boundary propagator on this tree. And then I have to sum over all the J's along the boundary. And you, if you're familiar with ADS CFT dictionary, this is exactly what you would do if you turn on a boundary coupling. And if you want to compute expectation value of a bulk field. And so now you can do this order by order in this boundary coupling. You start with a linear term, and then you have quadratic term, and quadratic term will correspond to two of these J's propagating down at two different endpoints, and they meet somewhere, and then they further propagate to this bulk point. So this calculation is pretty much analogous to what you would do in usual ADS-CFT. So once we computed the expectation value of phi, then it is tempting to look for stress tensor in the bulk, and we could write down a general action of a bulk theory that contains the kinetic term, the mass term, and interaction term with unknown interaction couplings, and then we can compute the bulk stress tensor out of it. So this is the first part. Then the second part is, in order to have Einstein equation, we really need some notion of distance on this tensor network. And so so we made a guess. So remember, in this renormalization, the boundary in input of couplings states, they flow. And so perhaps one way of measuring distance is to ask, when I have flown this, when these states have flown to a certain layer, I would like to compare I would like to compare these couplings with the couplings from the next layer. So I could take an overlap between these coupling states and I define some sort of Fisher metric between these couplings in subsequent layers. And so perhaps that is some kind of measure of distance between two different layers. So let's take that as a working assumption. And so we expanded what we call distance up to fourth order in the couplings that we turn on at the boundary perturbatively. And we compared with this, a stress tensor that we can compute using this expectation value of phi. And very interestingly, as you can see, this is a result. When the self-interaction of the in the structure constants of these operators are non-zero, then J necessarily is proportional directly to the kinetic term and also a self-interaction term. So when you compute things up to J cubed, really d phi also contribute to J cubed. This term clearly contributes to J cubed. But what is quite interesting is that this term would no longer be necessary even if you work up to J cubed when the self-interaction term is not turned on. Yeah, it would vanish. So furthermore, we computed the box of Jn, and you can see that, okay, it is still related to basically kinetic terms and also a self-interaction term. It's slightly more complicated, but these coupling constants, but the numbers in front, what is important is that it is independent of how deep I am in the network. So I can always think of this as a coupling constant. So why am I doing this? The reason is this Nabla Jn really is is precisely the perturbative Riemann curvature. If I take J as a measure of length if I take the little j as a measure of distance on my network, then Nabla J, as it was shown by Gubser and company, I could really this is really related to the Ricci curvature in the on the graph. And so the expression that I have obtained here is some form of Einstein equation that emerges out of this tensor network. That is the point that I was trying to make. So of course we are quite mesmerized by the simplicity when of Jn, which is Jn is related to the stress tensor in some more simplistic way. So it leads to some guess that we're not entirely sure whether we should interpret J as the length or as a local measure of curvature. But in either way, the bottom line is there is some form of emergent Einstein equation where the coupling would look more complicated if J is a distance. But nevertheless, it looks like an Einstein equation that you can read off from this tensor network. Okay, so Let me also remark that we look into whether these curvatures have any sort of monotonicity, or whether it could mimic the notion of C theorem in real CFT. And the quick answer is we tried it for non-perturbatively for different fusion for the Ising fusion data, tampering with the conformal dimension, and it seems that by changing the conformal dimension, that the curvature doesn't appear to have a simple monotonicity relation, but it also could be that you need some specific constraints to have some monotonicity that is analogous to C theorem, but this is definitely still in progress. We can discuss more about that if you're interested. But so this is something to explore. Okay, so let me tune into a slightly different way of looking into deformation of the geometry. So this is related to something that we discovered back at the end of 2018. So the bottom line is, so in the previous slides, I show you a tensor network that recovers a p-adic CFT, and we realized that this p-adic this tensor network can actually be understood as a Wilson line network. So what do I mean? So for people who are familiar with the ADS CFT correspondence, in ADS 3, the Einstein-Hilbert action is can be rewritten by in the work of Witten. Is shown to be can be rewritten in terms of an SL2R cross SL2R Trans-Siemens theory. And the ADS3 metric can be written in terms of a flat connection of this SL2R cross SL2R gauge group. So if you try to mimic that story, then you find that it is actually possible to construct, to assume that the conformal group is a gauge group, and you can construct a flat connection corresponding to this gauge group. In this flat connection, I will have no time to go into detail. In this flat connection, you can compute three-point vertex of these Wilson lines, imposing gauge invariance at a vertex. So pretty interestingly, the tensor network that we found can be understood as a Wilson line vertex. If you treat PGL2QP as the gauge group and you construct a flat connection but in a way that is completely analogous to what happens in ADS3. Okay, so because of this parallel, so it suggests that maybe there's an interesting way to construct deformation away from pure ADS space, apart from the RG flow that we have considered in the previous slides. So namely, we know that in ADS gravity, we can construct black holes, we can construct non-trivial states where the stress energy tensor of the boundary CFT is non-vanishing. So in the case of a BTZ black hole, for example, the corresponding connection from the point of view when you write the metric, the BTZ metric, in terms of this SL2R connection, you find that it would take the following form, where L here is a parameter that tells you what is the stress tensor of the boundary CFT. So we want to mimic this story in the p-adic case to construct a network that corresponds to a BTZ black hole, perhaps. But on the other hand, because the tree is discrete, so we can't really talk about this infinitesimal connection. And so what we did is that why don't we exponentiate this A and to compute a small segment of the Wilson line, and so this is basically what we got. And so this is a group element in PGL2QP, but we parameterize, so the ADS3 case inspire us to parameterize a flat connection in PGL2QP that is parameterized by this variable L, and now this L is a p-adic number. And so we want to know what kind of tensor network would we recover if we look into the Wilson line vertex of this theory that now has a deformable parameter, which is a p-adic number. And what we find is a pretty amusing picture. So what we find is that once you have this p-adic number, all the Wilson line vertices actually would vanish if the separation of these endpoints of the Wilson line is bigger than a value controlled by this parameter L. The Wilson line vertex would basically vanish identically. And so right at this line that depends on the value of this L that we have put in, there's a sort of a cutoff of this geometry. The geometry just disappears completely below this line. And so it sort of have the smell of a black hole horizon, a Euclidean black hole horizon, where the geometry is cut off below this line. Moreover, if I cut off this network below a certain line, then you can see that there's an emergent periodicity. So in this particular case, you can see that the network, from the point of view of the boundary, repeats itself every four lengths. And what is the width of this at the boundary of this periodicity if you evaluate the p-adic norm of this width? It is precisely given by this 1 over square root L p-adic norm. And so if you compare these expressions, the position of the radius, the periodicity, it would matches with the expression that you would expect in ADS3 if you replace these norms by real norms rather than p-adic norms. And because of this similarity, it is very tempting to interpret that there is an entropy that you can attach to this black hole as well. And the entropy should be proportional to square root LP. And perhaps one way of understanding how this entropy comes about is that this is more or less counting the number of vertices that the horizon is cutting through the network. So I don't have more time to go into detail about this. We can discuss more if you're interested. But it looks like this deformation leads to some fairly familiar things that in ADS3 that is realized in this network. So this is so much about p-adic for now. So with about 10 minutes left, I want to move on to this minimal CFT business. So this work is done with another group of people, Roshui from Cornell, and my students, Xiangdong and Shen Ce. And I really have to thank PI particularly because the collaboration was forged while I was spending extended periods of time in PI as a another fellow. And that's when I met Gufrey's visiting student, Roshui, and she was really the star in this project in building out this, in teaching us the techniques and building up this networks almost completely single-handedly. So we're very indebted to her help. And this part is really not disconnected from what we have learned from the p-adic CFT. It's very much inspired by what we have done there. So what exactly have we learned from this p-adic CFT business? We find that, okay, first of all, it seems much easier to describe the partition function of the dual CFT rather than the wave function when we want to do quantitative computation. Because we preserve way more isometries, and so these pieces of the ADS-CFT dictionary just falls out more easily. Secondly, what we notice is that our partition function takes the form of a strange correlator, in which you see we have some dangling legs at the boundary of some two-dimensional structure, and if you we're taking a direct product state at the boundary and overlap it with this sort of two-dimensional wave function to recover the partition function of our one-dimensional CFT. And that is a point where I sometime last year I went to a talk of Frank, and I realized that there is some very profound similarity of how they computed the minimal the partition function of a series of minimal models using these strange correlators. And so this is what inspired what we're currently doing. So in order to understand these strange correlators and their connections with some topological orders, so let me just review quickly what's happening. So it was known for a while that tensor categories is related to many of these CFT minimal models. You can use data of tensor categories to construct the Hamiltonians or the of these CFT minimal models. And the partition functions of these minimal models can be thought of as imposing some boundary conditions on these topological models that are defined by these fusion tensor categories. There's some fairly recent work that demonstrate very explicitly how this is done, and you can also realize as a boundary condition, you can also realize these boundary conditions basically as these strange correlators, some direct product states, and you take an overlap with these wave functions of these topological models. And when you take the overlap of this direct product state with the these topological models, particularly you can take these Levin-Wen models constructed using this tensor category theory, you take the strange correlator overlap, and you find that an explicit realization that gives you the minimal the partition functions of the minimal models of the CFTs. And they're a very beautiful tensor network construction of these wave functions. And therefore, these minimal models, these strange correlators, admit very beautiful tensor network realization. And they look like the following. So these PEPs representation of the wave functions of Levin-Wen models have been around for quite a while. And our approach follows the work of Frank and company. And so what happens in what they have done is that these triangles are basically the tensors, and they correspond to the F symbols of these tensor categories. And the middle leg here, colored red, are the physical legs, and these other black lines are the auxiliary lines of these PEP tensors. And so to obtain the partition function of these minimal models, what happens is that you have to project these boundary these physical legs to very specific linear combinations of certain you have to project these physical legs in very specific ways. And once you do the projection, this Levin-Wen tensor network would recover the partition function of the minimal models. And so you can regard this projection as the so-called strange correlator, where omega n is this direct product state corresponding to this projection of every single physical leg, taking the overlap of this direct product state with the Levin-Wen wave function that is realizable as a tensor network. That gives you the partition function of CFTs, of different minimal models. You can construct different minimal models by changing the choice of topological models, and you would be able to get different partition functions. And so here it is. But then these partition functions, topological part of the partition this topological wave function is, you can relate to between different triangulations using F moves, Alexander moves, inherent of these topological models. And so starting with a direct product state overlapping with a particular triangulation, a wave function of the topological model with a particular triangulation, you can do multiple F moves to change the triangulation, and And you could think of that as a sort of renormalizing the direct product states, and it would get into more and more entangled with neighboring things. And so if you so people have already this is already known, and people have used this as a way to assist the usual procedure of tensor network renormalization (TNR). But when you stare at this object, it really looks like a mirror tensor network, where the omega n is some direct product state at the UV level, and these f's entangle them and just forms a network that looks like ADS space. And so it is very tempting to interpret this network composing of omega n times an infinite number of f's as our Euclidean ADS3 tensor network realization of this Euclidean ADS3 space. And now we're going this network is going to be able to describe a very realistic and specific CFT. People already knew how to insert operators into these tensor networks. So what you do is that you tile the tensors around a cylinder, and you look for eigenstates of the cylinders. And then once you find these eigenstates, which looks like a disk, you can do a replacement on the tensor. You can dig a hole in this tensor network and replace it by the disk, which are eigenstates of the cylinder, and that gives you the that allows you to insert operator into this tensor network. So let me comment that one observation that we have is that it turns out it appears as far as we could track in the Ising case, insertions of these eigenstates of primaries can be obtained by changing the projections that you do at the UV. At the UV level, and this is already pretty analogous to what happens at the in the p-adic tensor network, where if you want to insert operators, you basically change the boundary. You basically change the boundary conditions at the UV level, and that corresponds to operator insertion. Another boundary condition corresponds to no operator insertion. So this is already one similarity. And then we try to compute a bulk boundary propagator. What you want to do is basically to insert some operator in the interior, insert some operator at the boundary, and see if we could recover the bulk boundary propagator. So we have only tried for a couple of weeks. It's obviously still work in progress. And what we have found is that we have got something close, but not quite. So what happens is that this is the bulk boundary propagator in ADS space, and what we have got is we're so far missing this one here. So what that means really is that in what we have computed, the primaries are doing some descendants that should show up when you insert a local operator in the bulk. It corresponds to primary operator and a list of descendant operators. This is something that we know in ADS3. So basically we're currently missing this one, and it means that the descendants are not showing up as intended, and probably this has something to do with correctly dealing with sub-ADS locality in the network. That is a difficult problem, but we have some control over it because we have some idea of how to recover the descendants. But this is currently where we are. I believe I'm running out of time, or am I? Let me try to end quickly. Point number one is that we realize that this realization of the this strange correlator realization and this holographic network that recovers the partition function of minimal CFTs is really some discretized realization of Songsek's new paper, where he was also seeing that partition functions can be thought of as the overlap between some state that is invariant under renormalization and a non-trivial thing and a non-trivial state, and then as you take coarse grain this I, RG flow operator can be grouped with S, and it generates a flow in an extra in the extra dimension. And so what we're seeing here is a discretized realization of these ideas, I think. And so right now we're trying to have some quantitative control of the descendants. People have already some experience with how that is done in these fairly recent works. And so I believe that would allow us to obtain the right bulk boundary propagator and allow us to understand how sub-ADS locality is realized in these tensor networks. And because we know how to control descendants in these operators, so it would very likely allow us to control gravitational excitations. Of course, you could say in ADS3, we don't really have gravitational excitations, but I think the good news is this kind of strange correlators, I think they can be generalized to high dimensions because you can look for wave functions of high dimensional topological orders and look for strange correlators of these high dimensional topological wave functions, and you would also be able to grow a holographic bulk out of it. So this line of thought has immediate high dimensional generalization. They are profoundly related to categorical symmetry. There are lots of these ideas that Frank and other people have reviewed and discussed in the past 2 days. I will not have enough time to talk about my take on these things. I hope that we have presented some interesting possibilities of building realistic or useful holographic networks that might shed new light into the understanding of the ADS or CFT correspondence. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Thank you for the very nice talk. Do we have some questions? If so, then please feel free to unmute yourself and just ask it or write it into the chat or raise your hand, whatever you prefer.
I can ask a question. So Janet, you in your tree tensor network, when you introduced a bulk operator, you introduced an extra leg to one of the vertices in the tree?
Right. You might be referring to this picture.
Yes. So all the trivalent tensors here are simply the structure constants. So what is this four index tensor? Are these the structure constants in a 4-point function or?
That's right. So you basically you fuse one extra fuse one extra operator to the to this vertex. So you impose. So these four things have to be have to fuse to the trivial. So these four things fuse together to be a trivial representation.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Are there any more questions? So I would have a very basic question because I'm not very familiar with this p-adic formulation of ADS-CFT. Maybe you mentioned in the beginning and I missed it. So what would be the advantages and disadvantages of using the p-adic formulation of the ADS-CF correspondence and also of string theory and of Chern-Simons theory? So do you have some specific hopes? What kind of open problems you could solve with that?
Okay, so the issue with the p-adic CFT is that it's really way too simple. You can't see any descendants, and so the bulk is also discrete. So what people were interested in is that that there are two faults. One fault when Gubser and friends proposed looking into this is that first of all, because it's so simple, it might shed light into the microscopic mechanism of why what exactly is the Piatic, what exactly is ADS safety? In a toy model, maybe we could gain new insight into this black box. And a second hope, I believe, is that there's this so-called Adalic relation, where the product of all the Piatic norms, so every rational number is also a Piatic number. And if you take the Piatic norm and you take the product of all the Piatic norms together, all the way up to infinity, that actually recovers a real norm. So in some extent, in some mysterious way, maybe the product of all of these Piatic ADS put together, or tensor them together in some way, might be related to the real continuous version of the ADS. Well, nobody knows how to do that, but I believe one reason why people were interested in the Piatic form of the CFT is that there is potentially such a relation. But for us, the motivation is that because the CFT is so simple and the dual bulk is so simple, it becomes possible to actually try to see if to put a tensor network there and see if important ingredients of the ADS CFT would emerge from the tensor network. So that would provide extra provide extra evidence that a tensor network's description makes sense, and that it might. So it did inspire us to some extent to find ways to construct tensor networks that describe more realistic CFT. So it gives us some intuition how things are done. But itself by itself is not very realistic. It's way too simple.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so are there more questions? If not, then thank you very much again for the very interesting talk.